Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. 2016 has been a hard year for Minnesotans. In April, we lost beloved music icon Prince to an overdose of painkillers. In July, we watched in horror as Philando Castile breathed his last breaths after being shot by a police officer during a routine traffic stop. And in September, Danny Heinrich confessed to kidnapping, sexually assaulting, and killing 11-year-old Jacob Wetterling, bringing to a close a missing persons case that haunted families for nearly three decades. Those are just some of the stories that affected us deeply over the past year. When we grieve the loss of a loved one, it's normal for us to turn to our community for support. But how do we cope when the whole community is grieving? And how can grief transform a community? Joining me this hour is Reverend Karen Hutt. She's a Fairview Clinical Pastoral Education Educator at University of Minnesota Medical Center in Minneapolis. Karen, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by phone by Dr. Janice Nadeau. Sorry about mispronouncing your name there. Marriage and family psychologist and therapist. Dr. Nadeau, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Yes, thanks for inviting me.
We'd also like to hear from you. How have you processed these experiences of the past year? How have you seen it affect your family or neighbors? You can also be sure and give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. You can also join us online at nprnews.org/live. Again, 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Reverend Hutt, we often talk about the stages of grief and loss, denial, bargaining, anger, etc. Can those stages of grief be experienced as a community?
Oh, absolutely. I think certainly with the descriptions of the things that you described that happened right here in Minnesota this year, those stages of grief were, you know, probably very apparent for different people, but and individuals and communities. But one of the things that's kind of tricky about those stages is that they become inescapable for us because they become so embedded in our culture, and sometimes it doesn't give room for a more nuanced analysis of the contextual nature of that grief. I'm thinking specifically about different types of reactions that people have, even to the Philando Castile case. I mean, there's horror, there's disbelief, but sometimes if your disbelief about a situation causes a different type of grief than one that is always expecting this to happen. For instance, for me, I don't not expect that to happen, African Americans, as an African American. So my grief, there's very little denial process for certain communities, whereas other communities, there is a denial process. So the grief stages may work contextually very differently.
Yeah, and then as a result, if you have different parts of the community who are grieving in different ways at different times, that can certainly, it seems like that's ripe for miscommunication and hurt to happen.
Yes, yes. I mean, even with the election and those largely European Americans expressing solidarity as allies with safety pins caused a certain amount of grief or anger and frustration on the part of other people of color who saw that as just sort of a weak response to something like that. So people, you know, depending on where you are and your cultural context and your social location, your grief and even your definition of grief is going to be different. Certainly, I see that all the time in hospitals over the years is that, you know, people, certain communities will grieve as a community in the hospital, which is not necessarily the most acceptable behavior in a very sterile European-American culturally sanitized environment. So even different people grieving can sometimes not be acceptable in the larger culture.
Dr. Nadeau, in your work with marriage and family psychology and therapy, and you deal with grief at the family level, is that sort of similar, a sort of a microcosm of a community, and when you deal with different members of the family experiencing grief and loss from the same event?
Well, yes, and if you don't mind, I first of all want to say thank you for covering this subject. I think it's way overdue.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm very happy to hear my favorite radio station doing this.
Excellent. Happy to help.
Then I have just a couple of thoughts, and then I'd like to respond to that family
sure.
question. I think right off at the starting gate, we need to be very careful thinking about the stages of grief. It turns out, I have my finger on the pulse of the research and academic community around grief, and mm-hmm. it turns out that we really don't have any research that backs up the notion of stages of grief. And I think the trap is we normalize some sort of, or the risk rather, we normalize some sort of pattern of grieving that is the right way to do it. And if we don't someday get to that level of acceptance, we somehow failed. And I think we need to be very careful not to lay that on people.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to say that one.
Yes, absolutely.
I think it's really important. Kubler-Ross, who came up with those stages, really was talking about the process of dying and not grieving.
Right.
Not that they aren't related.
Right. So this, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was talking about when you face death, that
yes.
there's this process you go through. It's not
yes.
specific necessarily to all sorts of grief and loss. And yes. that everybody grieves differently.
And that's exactly the point, Marianne. And that's, I think, a very important thing. Whatever level of a system we're dealing with, whether it's within an individual or the family level or the community level, we have to be careful to remember that it really isn't in the generalities. As Paul Rosenblatt at the University of Minnesota would say, it's really, truly, it's in the particulars of a given situation, not in the generalities.
Mm.
And I worry that we try to be too almost formulaic about what grief should be.
Mm, absolutely.
And then the other one, I draw on my nursing background to say that I like to think of grief, and my clients have been helped by this idea over the years, I like to think of grief as a healing process. And I think it was Socrates who said, the beginning of knowledge is in the definition of terms. And if we think of our losses, whatever they are, from the loss of a pocket knife to the loss of a loved one, as an injury, and if the grief is the healing process that corresponds to that injury, I think it turns our thinking around a little bit and keeps us from thinking of grief as a disease or something to be gotten over. And if I've heard one thing, I've probably heard it at least for 30 years, people are so hurt by being told or getting the message from our society that they need to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
They need to resolve it, or they need to recover. And it makes no sense to say, I need to recover from a healing process. So I hope that's useful.
Very useful. Go ahead, Karen.
Just get in there. I think what Doctor's saying there is really important, because a related myth is that, you know, that we're all, that there's the grief work hypothesis, which defines grief as a project that must be tackled in order to prevent psychological problems.
That sounds very American.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, just think about Day of the Dead, a celebration of death. I mean, there are many cultures that deal with grief in very many different ways. But in our American culture, it's a project that it can, and this is tracked back to Freud, who wrote, now I'm not a psychologist, so I'll turn it over to the doctor there, but traced back to Freud, who wrote that the work of mourning was for the ego to detach itself from, you know, the deceased so that they could reattach itself to someone else.
Hmm.
So that is pretty much a guiding principle that does sort of define the American modern grief theory. But it's really very important that I think that we do try to debunk some of these myths about grief so that we're able to actually have some really honest conversations and, again, contextual conversations based on culture and social location and language and, as Doc was saying, about defining the terms. I mean, what does it really mean? You know, we talk about different types of grief that people experience, and I think that's a really valuable conversation because often there's the disenfranchised or the complicated grief or the exaggerated grief doesn't get explored as much as, you know, what is considered normal grief.
Right, so, right. Yeah. And I want to get into those different kinds of grief in just a minute. We're talking this hour about grief experienced as a community. When a community goes through several traumatic events like the Minnesotans have in the past year, how does that affect us at the community level and how do we process that grief? You know, give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. And you can reach us online at nprnews.org/live. Let's go to the phones. We've got Deborah on the line from Minneapolis. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was really excited to hear the conversation that you were going to have today. And what we have going on in our family is my niece, who is 14 years old, has experienced a number of sort of different losses within her community. So a child at school committed suicide, her uncle died suddenly, and then someone at church died, an elder person at church died. And my niece has, through the course of all this, had lots of anxiety about, like, she started making the connection to, like, when will my grandma die? And she has quietly gone through all this anxiety, and we finally were able to just, her and I were just able to start talking about this. And to me, what's really interesting is there is no place for kids to talk about loss and death and dying and how do they process that. And I'm just wondering, like, one, I think just being able to listen to her and acknowledge her feelings and her fears and just have an open sort of foundation for her to talk about that. But I'm also wondering if there's any resources that I could offer her other than just communicating about it.
Sure.
I told her to talk to her grandma, who's experienced a lot of losses. But I just think that's such an important thing that no one's really talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, Janice Nato, yeah, go ahead.
Yes, there's a website called Open to Hope. .com, and it's one of the most popular and long-lasting websites, and there are wonderful resources on that website. It's reliable. It's professional people who are doing it. Things are very carefully chosen for that website, and I think that you would find some help there. I also believe that there have been many high schools who have, when these kinds of things have come up, especially the death of a student, where there's been a room where students can go and talk with someone or to write something or to do something about the student who was lost. And it's probably as good a time as any to say what happens to us when we have a loss like that, and particularly for your niece, Deborah, is lots of other things get set off, like her fear about when is her grandpa going to die. When will she die? And we have this, again, I'm going back to theory. I guess that might be what happens to us when we work on PhDs. We think about theory. But, you know, the idea of reminder theory is the notion that when we see something that triggers us, we are reminded of our own losses. And bringing that around to the community level, when we do something as a community ritual, most people are both reminded of their own losses, including the one that we might be ritualizing, but also any other losses that they've experienced. So on the one hand, we get set off by seeing things in the community, whether it's, you know, lots of flowers like were placed at the Prince residence. That reminds us of funerals and other events in our lives. So on the one hand, we get reminded, and that can increase our distress. But on the other hand, it validates our pain and makes us feel more like we belong to community. You know, that notion that when we share our joys, the joys are multiplied, but when we share our sorrows, they're divided. And if there's a rule of thumb for community grief, I think that would probably be it.
Karen Hutt?
I would also add to that, I worked with a number of adolescents and children here at the U in our behavioral health program here at Fairview, and I remember with a group of adolescents once doing a personal loss history with them, asking them the first death that they remember and the feelings they had at the time. Just sort of normalizing a conversation about it is a big deal, because often, even at the moment of death, sometimes in the hospital room, I've noticed over the years that the teenager, the young adult, the child is often off to the side trying to process all of this. People are patting them on the shoulder, but no one's really talking directly to them. It's obviously the focus on the spouse or the adults in the room, and the children are kind of left to the side to kind of sort it out themselves. So this conversation you're having with your niece is so important, but I encourage you also to have, part of normalizing some of this stuff is saying, okay, you've had a lot of losses. Let's maybe write about this, or keeping a journal on how you're coping with the loss, or knowing how it's feeling on different days, whatever seems appropriate for her at that time. But all of us, adults included, should do some kind of a personal loss history, just so that we can get in touch with the long-term nature of our lives and the many losses that we're going to experience. I mean, loss is an event, but grief is sort of the response to it and what we do with that loss.
Mm. We're talking this hour about how we grieve as a community when we are hit by sudden events or losses that perhaps are not from our immediate family, say the loss of a beloved music icon like Prince, or when the resolution of the Jacob Wetterling trial, when we found out that indeed, yes, he had been murdered those 27 years ago. How we process these things as a community. If you'd like to join with your comment, question, observation, you can give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000, or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. Again, that's 1-800-242-2828. And you can join us online at nprnews.org/live. Also, Karen Hutt, we were talking earlier about the different types of processing grief, and you mentioned disenfranchised grief. Talk a little bit about what that means and the different other kinds of grief and their timelines.
Well, timelines I'm not going to ever put on anything, because I agree with the other doctor that's been a problem with us.
Right.
And our timelines in the United States are immediate and
right.
over.
And we'd like to say here, normal is all we know about normal is it's a setting on the dryer.
Exactly. Well, even though we all fall into the habit of using that.
Yes.
But disenfranchised grief is something, I can speak to that personally.
Sure.
I was very active in tending to the needs of the community of people with HIV and AIDS in the 80s, and watched a number, maybe close to 100 friends and associates die. We were going to funerals literally every week. And so this was a community that was experiencing an onslaught of death that was just unexplainable for us in the early years. And one of the things that made it very difficult was that we weren't allowed to really grieve publicly at the funerals, because at almost all of these funerals, most of these were gay men. The family was up in one part, and then the friends were in the back of the funeral. I officiated at a number of funerals where this was the case, where, so our grief was not considered important, because we were ostracized by the society, so our grief did not get the same kind of support until we demanded through political action and through the AIDS quilt and ACT UP and all kinds of other movement-building activities, that our grief became public and it was acceptable. But in the early years, we were really disenfranchised with regard to our grief. Also, Black grief and pain has been used. Even the death of Black bodies has been used to further our grieving process, which is a big controversial subject right now, because, every time a Black body is killed by the police or in any setting, the viral nature of that video or that article or that photograph sets off a firestorm, a visualization of Black death. And sometimes it's very voyeuristic in the similar way that it was in the turn of the last century when postcards were sent out by people who had lynched Black people, because those lynchings often accompanied photographs and postcards that were sold to celebrate this death. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the homes of Black people were flooded with these images after to terrorize people. So images of death, images of grief, and then the idea that, too, we need to get over it, you know, the same thing that people are telling people about individual groups. You know, that happened a long time ago. Get over it. You know, so but this culmination of trauma that Native people experience, people that have been, you know, systematically managed by the United States government, particularly African Americans and Native Americans, are the two groups that have been systematically managed. Mm. So our communities have particular kinds of grief that if we actually ever really expose the grief, we would all probably lose our minds because we can't let that out or else we wouldn't be able to function.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Sue on the line. Sue, welcome to the conversation.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling in. All three of the deaths that you talked about affected me, but mostly as I was listening to the comments by both of the speakers there, as far as with Philando Castillo, I know I've experienced a lot of anger. I'm Native American, and I know what it's like to be treated less than. I just had a situation in my life about 2 months ago. I had called the police in my hometown and reported that my husband, I was afraid of him. And what happened is basically I was the one that was asked to leave. And then when I came back to try and go to bed, they told me if I went in the house, they were going to put me in jail.
Mm.
And I know that this happened because I'm Native American, because I know racism every day. And it's been really painful. And by listening to your program, I realized that I've been experiencing grief, some sort of grief because of that, because I didn't feel like I was important enough for the police to do anything.
Mm. So, thanks so much for your call, Sue. I really appreciate that. Karen Hutt, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, again, like I was saying earlier, often because of the long-term systemic dehumanization of Native people in this culture, there's an assumption that their pain is not real pain. And you can see this in studies that have been done in the medical world around people not giving pain medication to Native folks the same way they would give it to white folks because their pain, they're drug seeking or something. So these stereotypes and assumptions, and again, it's not seeing the other as self that causes many of these kinds of incidents to occur. And again, if we responded the way we want to respond sometimes in these situations, we'd find ourselves at a great disadvantage. So we bury it. We hold on to it. We realize when we hear a radio show that, hey, I'm grieving. This hurts. Pain. Mm-hmm. I have real pain. And it is worth listening to and engaging and paying attention to in a way that you would to somebody else. So, you know, obviously racism and classism has a lot to do with it as well. Mm. I think this election, another area where people are having some grief, has caused some folks to say and do things that are expressions of their frustration. But how we talk to one another about our grief is also going to become the question for the coming year.
Yeah, we had somebody call in. Bob from St. Paul says, I feel like I'm starting to grieve the loss of our democracy.
Yeah.
And that I've heard that sentiment a lot of late with questions about how President-elect Trump is preparing to lead the country, and that their people are feeling a sense of grief over what's going on. And how does that change the situation at all? Is that how do we recognize that or work with that if there is a sense of, okay, people are grieving this?
You know, I think one of the things that I've seen in my clients is that it's certainly multi-layered, but that this whole situation, not only with the election of Trump, but also with the entire political process of the last year, it's been so vicious, and there have been so many things that have come across the airways that have triggered people. And what I've found here in my practice is that people are having reactions. Some people have responded to the talk about sexual abuse, and some of the language that's been used has either helped them to identify that they were also victims. Some of them are recalling things that they haven't recalled until now. It's back again to that notion of being triggered by all of this. So we have not only how it brings up what has happened to people in the past, but also, I would almost say, the anticipated losses of the future as President Trump takes office. So I think that one is a tough one. And even as I was thinking about this presentation today, right now, what I see in my clients is three or four different levels of, I want to say levels of grief, but actually things that are making it very difficult for people to live from day to day. I'm glad that we're doing the program on the winter solstice.
Yes.
This is our shortest day, and someone said this morning that we're going to pick up four more minutes of daylight this week, and I couldn't be happier.
Yes, these are dark times that we're living in, literally.
Yes. And people in my practice who are depressed or who are having many of them their first Christmas without a family member, the cold weather and that sharp wind, today's much better, has been part of it. Another level of it is that people have difficulty with the holiday times, so that there's grief around that, both in memories and hoping that this holiday will be better. I mean, I think about my families where they've lost a child, and they're going out shopping, trying to shop for Christmas gifts for the other children.
Mm.
Or they're thinking about what would they like to buy for this child who's no longer here. Mm-hmm. People who are widowed for the first time, and they're trying to get through Christmas without a spouse. And some of the older marriages where it's all been so automatic, and now they've got to reinvent it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have what's going on in Aleppo.
Right.
There's just one level after another. I say there's about five that my clients are responding to. And we're not fixing anything by talking about it, but there is healing in people being able to say, this is what's going on for me.
Yeah.
To that, too, because you talked about the cold wind, you know, the cold temperatures and the sharp wind.
Yes.
And that's a great image, because one of the things that can help in these situations is movement and communication and connection. And those are the things, and one of the things it makes us uniquely human is that we can, you know, take our minds to different places for different purposes. But now more than ever, we really have to make an effort to move. And not just be in a movement, but to move physically, emotionally, and stay connected, you know, to what is good. And now I'm going to be a minister for a minute, and connect with people around us. You know, we can't. For anyone listening out there, we have to allow ourselves not to get stuck in ruminating only in our fears of the future, because that was going to paralyze us. There will be so much greater good that we can do if we move.
But I got to get in there, because you're saying we need to move. We can't get stuck. But doesn't that sound an awful lot like hurry up and get over it?
No, but I mean move in it. And okay. I think I'm not saying it in the best way, but being able to move in the process. of the grief, of the strengthening, of relationship. I'm thinking about this in terms of relationship. I think there are many people that are feeling isolated and feeling alone. And then when you see it, but the movement I saw that was so encouraging was this sort of random street actions that took place after the election, just people just walking outside. And if you looked at the people that gathered on street corners all over the country after the election to express whatever they wanted to express, there was strength in that. There was movement in that. They didn't necessarily know where they were going. They were grieving. They were angry. They were this, but they were moving, sometimes just in circles around the street corner, bearing witness. And that's courage, you know, and there's hope in that showing up. Even if you're grieving and angry, there's hope and courage in that that can arise from that kind of movement. So that's kind of how I'm looking at movement. Not to get over it, but the end.
I think Mary Ann's idea that it can very easily sound like get over it and move forward. And I'm much of a proponent of doing both. I think the successful folks are the ones who are able to say, here's the sad part, this is what I feel grief about. I'm grieving these things, and at the same time, I have a plan to go forward. Some of our best grief models now, I think particularly of the work of Hank Schut and Margaret Struwe in the Netherlands, is about, it's a dual process model. You move back into the pain of the past, and then you turn and you move forward into the action of the future. And I don't think we can not do either one.
And we can walk around in circles sometimes, too.
That's kind of where I'm at a lot of the time. And, you know, the first part of the circle might look like forward and the second part like that one. But it's all in perspective, isn't it?
Yes. We're talking this hour about grief in community and a surprising amount of laughter considering we're talking about grieving as a community this hour. But we'd appreciate if your call or comment, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can reach us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to your calls in just a moment, but first it's time for an update from the NPR Newsroom with Phil Picardi. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Marianne. A senior German security official says the Tunisian man who is now being sought in connection with Monday's truck attack in Berlin had been considered a possible terror threat by German authorities. The official says security agencies had exchanged information about this person, most recently in November. And he says state police had launched proceedings against the man on suspicion that he was preparing a serious crime. Separately, he says German authorities rejected the man's asylum request in July. In the aftermath of the Christmas market attack in Berlin and the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey, Donald Trump is meeting today with his incoming national security advisor, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. The process of filling out Trump's cabinet and other high-level posts is also continuing. Trump's transition team expects to announce White House positions in the coming days. 31 people have now died and dozens more were injured in the explosions and fires at the San Pablito Fireworks Market north of Mexico City. The market was well stocked for the holidays and bustling with shoppers when powder ignited. 47 people remain hospitalized. Among them, 10 are children. Authorities have not yet said what may have touched off the explosions. And thousands of pagans, druids, and revelers gathered at Britain's Stonehenge today to celebrate the winter solstice. Today is the shortest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. People played musical instruments while others sang and took photographs of the rising sun. From now until the June solstice, the days will be getting longer. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 10:39.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, more discussion on sexual assault on campus. You heard last hour about investigations like the one around the Gopher football team and how those investigations work. Well, next hour, a broader discussion about rape culture, and you'll hear a survivor story. Join us at 11.
Programming is supported by the University of Minnesota Press, publisher of Sky Blue Water, great stories for young readers, edited by Jay Peterson and Colette Morgan, with contributions from some of Minnesota's most loved authors, upress.umn.edu.
Listen, can you hear the sound of hearts beating all the world around? Down in the valley, out on the plain, everywhere around the world, a heartbeat sounds the same. Black or white, red or tan, it's the heart of the family of man. Whoa, beating away. Whoa, beating away. Whoa, beating away.
That music, that was a favorite song of Jacob Wetterling and was performed at his memorial earlier this year. With the Annie Heinrich confessed to his kidnapping, sexually assaulting, and killing 11-year-old Jacob Wetterling back in, I believe it was 1989. And there's a whole generation of families, of youth, of kids who grew up who are 11-year-old, about 11 years of age at that time, who grew up with that story, that mythic story, which came to a close this year. This year, we're talking about, this hour, we're talking about grief, how we deal with grief as a community. My guests are Reverend Karen Hutt, who's Fairview Clinical Pastoral Education Educator at the University of Minnesota Medical Center in Minneapolis, and also Dr. Janice Nadeau, psychologist and therapist for marriage and families. And this hour, we've been talking a lot. We've got a lot of callers on the line. I'd like to go right to the phones. Let's go to Mary from Minneapolis. Mary, welcome to the conversation.
Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us.
Mary. Oh, hi. Well, my name is Mary, and I'm from North Minneapolis. And talk about community grief. I just see the violence and both as a reflection of untreated grief and just wonder what we're doing as a community to address that. I see, and you know, one child will commit suicide in a suburban school, and that school is flooded with counselors, but you have a whole community that's flooded with violence and shootings, and these kids are dealing with this and oftentimes reacting back with grief. And I guess I really want to make a point of that and just have a different way of looking at
sure.
that violence.
Yeah.
And how much of the community are we willing to look at that as a symptom of grief and maybe supporting those families and those children, particularly those young people,
okay.
To yeah. change that behavior and to grapple with that.
Great.
That level
thank you, thank yeah. you, Mary. I'm going to go straight to Reverend Karen Hutt and say, so yeah, we're talking about North Minneapolis, an area where sometimes there's more violence, more shootings, and the kids who grow up with that, the grief they deal of what they see in their community. How do we deal? How do we help communities deal with grief like that? That's ongoing.
Well, I'm not from Minneapolis, but I came most recently from Chicago, where I worked with a lot of kids who in a trauma center. So I saw this every day. But one of the things that actually seemed to help was to have opportunities and programs in the schools that address this on a regular basis. So I knew one school that actually had a grief program. You know, somebody there who could talk about grief, a grief counselor, so to speak. Though I don't want to use that term loosely, but someone that was able to address that. And also all the teachers in this particular school went through a significant amount of training how to recognize certain kinds of behaviors, because a lot of the kids that I also worked in juvenile justice, a lot of the kids that were incarcerated for committing violent acts or, you know, criminal behavior in these communities that were impoverished also were experiencing trauma.
Mm.
So until their trauma is addressed, certain kinds of behaviors aren't going to be addressed. Until their grief is addressed,
they're going to probably cause even more grief in the community. Mm-hmm. So, and again, I go back to the fact that many of these young people, you know, in the 90s were considered just, you know, predators, bad people. So the labels that are associated with poor people of color in particular often don't lend themselves to that those kinds of resources being instituted into those communities, whereas, you know, in suburban communities, oh, of course, we're going to have grief counselors show up, as the caller said.
Right.
So there has to be a priority that their lives are just as important in terms of their processing of grief. Some of the most successful programs that I've seen are programs that have been started by teenagers themselves or young adults themselves
really?
Who've experienced significant grief. Yeah, I think I could make some references to those if I look them up. But I remember in Chicago, a couple of teens who had lost their parents to violence, you know, started a whole little program in their school. And they made sure that anyone who had witnessed violence or had violence had a buddy and somebody that would stick with them and call them every night or text them every day and see how they're doing. Again, this was to lower their retaliation for a certain kind of behavior, but also to help them deal with their pain.
Yeah. Dr. Nato, is there a risk when we have grief that's experienced as a community that we somehow normalize it and say, well, everybody's going through this right now, and so we don't make space for it, make space for people to grieve?
Well, yeah, I think there certainly is a risk. I don't think there's any way that we could do too much about grief. It's possible, but I don't think it's likely. We are so busy trying to fix things and get Band-Aids on things and label folks that I don't think we're as creative as we might be, nor do we think of it in enough of a comprehensive way. I'm glad that Mary called in and that she talked about how these kids are acting out in various ways, and underneath it is so much grief. I think that's true whatever community we're talking about in whatever situation. But the risk, I think, is when we have partial stories or when we hear just snippets of something and there's no real recognition of the toll that takes on people. Some of the folks that I see here, I have to recommend to them in my private practice, I have to recommend that they turn the radio off and turn the TV off for a while. They get this kind of compassion overload. They just can't feel anymore. And the other part of it is when they're having very serious losses themselves, and then they see things like what's on the screen about Aleppo and these various other, here we've just seen the Russian ambassador be shot, and we've watched that how many times on CNN. How does a person who's had a loss not quite like that feel that their loss is significant? And so I think there's this sort of prioritizing or putting in some kind of a rank order how bad something is. And people who are exposed to terrible violence and to the things that we see every day minimize their own losses. So they can get overloaded by seeing so much. They also can minimize the pain, their own pain. And so I can see it going both ways. I don't think I'm being very clear about that. But I think we have to be mindful that we have to titrate in some way how much of the how much we take in at a given time. My fear is that we get numb and that we get so numb that we stop feeling the real impacts. And I think what Pastor Karen is saying is just very much that. We see so much Black death that we've gotten numb to it, and perhaps we always have been. But the same thing happens for all kinds of losses.
Right. Reverend Hutt, I know you need to leave here in just a minute. Any final thoughts as we talk about, you know, grief as
a
community?
I'm good for another 5 minutes.
Oh, well, then I'll keep you on for another 5 minutes.
Yeah,
fabulous. That's great.
Good.
You know, but we're talking about this sort of impact on the community, and Dr. Nato was talking about turning off the television, turning off these images of violence. And I know on social media there are a lot of people saying, you know, I just can't right now. I can't deal with all of this. I'm tuning out. I'm turning out. I'm turning off. And then other people are saying, but wait. We need to know what's going on. We need to face the reality of what's going on in our world. What, is there a right answer here?
No, I don't think there's a right answer. I mean, everybody has to do what makes sense for them. And I think that, that the term titrate, I think, is a great one for people who, particularly who are getting counseling and who are getting some kind of advice on how to handle their own particular situation. I know that in my family, my partner probably loved it if I sort of titrated a little bit of the right-wing radio that I listen to every night, and because I feel like I have to know what's going on and what's coming. It's just sort of...
So you sample it a little bit, and then...
Well, actually, I'm a little bit more of a consumer than a sampler. It's ridiculous, but it's a personal problem. But still, I think it's so interesting that I've responded to so many of these horrific stories. I have two children, two beautiful children, and for my oldest child, the Trayvon Martin case was the first time she got activated, and we were living in Chicago at the time. She went to the first march ever, and then, you know, we moved to Minneapolis, and now there's more, and then there's more, and there's more. And I am finding it hard to talk to her about it, because I keep saying, no, there's going to be this. You know, I'm trying to make her believe that there would be justice, there will be fairness. And now she's just as cynical as my grandfather was, my great-grandfather was, who lived to be 109, who was born right after the emancipation, who says that that process of emancipation was just a coffee break for black people. So I'm still mired in this story, this trajectory of pain and loss and justice, and I'm passing on in another generation this same lack of this is a certain kind of ineptitude that I almost feel like I have, because I can't protect my kids.
Right.
It's complicated, but I do think you got to tune in when you can and keep aware. As we say in the black community, you got to stay woke.
Yeah.
So stay woke.
We've talked about Prince a couple of times this hour, and I'd like to bring up a clip for you to listen to here. This is from the night after it was revealed that Prince had died.
Never meant to cause you any sorrow. Oh, I never meant to cause you any pain.
That's Chastity Brown, and she's singing at outside First Avenue. This happened the night of Prince's death. This amazing crowd gathered and celebrated and sang together, and it was this cathartic process. And then over the next hours, you saw almost, it felt like the entire world was turning purple. I mean, the Eiffel Tower and other monuments were being lit purple. And I wonder, I remember seeing comments being made on social media, if only we could always be this good. The way we came together around his death and the way we behaved. And I wonder if there are opportunities for transformation in this community grieving that happens.
I certainly think there is. We're grieving on the community level, but we're also grieving internally for our own and privately for our own losses. I think if we could almost say that grieving is an equalizer to a greater or lesser extent. People use various channels to do their own grief work about things, and I think people who lost young family members did some grieving about them in addition to the grief about Prince. It was almost a medium for it. And I do believe in the restorative power of these rituals. It's the only way that we really can fully embrace our losses. And I think the most important thing, and I'm glad you're talking about it in terms of community, is that we're doing this together. It's the idea that this was a tragic thing. The meaning of Prince's death was awful. I've been into the meaning-making process in families. That's been my doctoral work. And the meaning that's attached to that death, I think, was extremely important. How much he contributed to everyone around the world, and what a valuable person he was in that way. But the meaning of it specifically was, this shouldn't have happened. This young man, with all that he had, I believe, died alone in the elevator, if I've heard the story right,
right.
And remember it correctly. I mean, that particular meaning, I think, is immensely painful.
Yeah.
And if when someone dies at 98, my mom died two summers ago, she kind of slept away. I mean, who wouldn't want to die that way? But to die alone in an elevator makes for a very different grief, both in a community way and also for individuals who've experienced the loss of family members.
And Reverend Karen Hutt, I mean, do you find that there are opportunities for transformation as we grieve as a community?
I do, and I think ritual is really something that we're not paying enough attention to in terms of, I mean, we watch the teddy bears, we see the flowers, but actually having opportunities for people to, and we do have memorials and all kinds of things, funerals, obviously these things are ritualized, but making more public space available for rituals on an ongoing basis, I think, would be really helpful for all of us. I think that that's where, you know, pretty soon those things get cleaned up and swept away because they're taking up too much space. But creating public spaces for healing, public spaces for grieving, public spaces for this type of community gathering to be able to constantly talk about these things. There should be a place, like a holy place in every neighborhood where people can go. That's a bit of a sanctuary. That's a bench that someone can sit on and know that somebody might come along and say, you know, how's it going?
All right.
So sometimes we need to talk. I just want to do a little quick plug as I leave. I have a book that just came out, and there are 16 essays. It's called The Call to Care, Skinner Books, but they're all essays about the work of chaplains dealing with this topic. So.
Oh, great. Thank you for that, The Call to Care. Thanks so much for joining us, Reverend Hutt. We really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Take care.
You
nice
too.
Meeting.
Bye. Dr. Nato, a question for you. What happens when we don't grieve, if we repress that?
Well, I think when Mary called in, she suggested that. I think it gets converted. Our grief gets converted to other emotions, oftentimes more negative, and oftentimes sometimes people become depressed, not always. Depression and grief are quite different, even though they may look the same. I think that one of the things that happens when we don't grieve, in order to not grieve, we have to shut down emotionally. And unfortunately, our system doesn't work in such a way that we can shut down to just the bad things. We also shut down to the good things. And when people get blocked and get numb and kind of shut down, I think is a wonderful word. It's not exactly psychobabble, but it works. So it takes the richness out of life. It's somehow, if we're going to stay shallow about our losses, we may feel shallow about the joys in life as well.
And we just have a minute left here, but I'm wondering, for those people who are stuck somehow and can't get to that grieving process, are there things that can trigger that they can do to sort of help bring that about?
I have people writing quite often about their losses. Creating a timeline, as Pastor Karen was suggesting, can be helpful. I believe that people grieve when they're able. Sometimes it's months and sometimes it's years later. We can grieve any time, any old loss that can still be effective and can help us to feel free. But sometimes people are so exhausted that there's something in them that just says, you know what, you need to take it easy here. You need to just tread water for a while until you have the strength and the energy and the stability to lean in, as they say, just leaning into the pain.
All right.
You know what I have in front of me? I have just a little poem.
Okay.
Actually, it's the song words.
We got 30 seconds.
Cohen.
Do you have? Okay. Can you read it in 30 seconds?
Yeah, I can.
All right,
can.
Here we go.
Leonard Cohen, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That is how the light gets in.
Leonard Cohen, another musical great that we lost this year.
Right at the time we voted.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And Dr. Nato, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's really been a lovely conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Janice Nato, family and marriage and family psychologist and therapist. And here's a little bit more Chastity Brown to take us out.